Good evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash, later on Building Bridges, protesting the devastatingly high unemployment among blacks and Latinos in New York City.
But first, women at Walmart charge discrimination. A federal judge ordered Walmart to stand trial, in effect, for company-wide sexual discrimination in the largest case of its kind ever. And with us to discuss the implications of that is Jennifer Shin. Jennifer is a staff attorney with the Equal Rights Advocates, and Claudia Renate, a plaintiff in the Walmart lawsuit and former Sam's Club associate. Welcome to Building Bridges.
Good evening.
Well, we always start with the workers. Why don't you give us an understanding about your experience as a worker with Walmart? What was it like to work there, and what makes you say in this suit that you were discriminated against?
I started in 1993 and went into the Walmart family through Sam's Club, and the orientation, everything promotes.
Let me just stop you for 1 second. I'm not sure everybody here knows exactly what Sam's Club is, so maybe you can just give us some background on that.
Sam's Club is a warehouse shopping, like Costco. I'm not sure if you have those on.
Yeah, we're a little more familiar with Costco.
And so Sam's Club is a subsidiary of Walmart.
And your experience?
I came in 93. I was constantly looked over for advancement, even though I asked for it several times, and pretty much was told that either I had to move to Alaska and uproot my family, sell our home, my husband was 25 years at his company, or I didn't have a chance where they would bring in a male off the street, the district operator's manager, who would then be placed as manager for myself, my manager, who I would train. And this happened over and over and over. And I finally went to Fair Housing and Equal Rights over this, and I think it was 97 or 98, and I was basically told that because of how huge Walmart was, that I had a great case, but they just didn't have the funds to fight them.
What about your day-to-day experience as a Walmart worker? What was it like?
First year, you're just so gung-ho because they tell you you can go anywhere. You can be anything. Anything you want to do is out there for you. If you want to go from a cart runner to the general manager, it's a possibility. And then after a year, going on 2 years, you start to realize that you work hard. I mean, you give 100% or more. You're at the cheers every morning. You're running around pretty much with your head cut off trying to make and meet every demand they give you, and you don't get anywhere. They've already pre-selected who they want into management. So every time you apply for it, it's a done deal already before you get there. And so it becomes discouraging. You become an employee that just goes to work every day thinking, well, you know, there must be something. It's wrong with me. You just keep going on and on trying to apply, applying, telling them where you want to go. And in my case, it got to where I was, after knee surgery from a workman's comp injury, I was told that I'd have to lift 50 pounds of dog food, and I was over 45 at that time, for 2 hours consistently to get into the management and training program. And I finally said, you know, am I going to go anywhere here? And they basically told me no. And this is after 7 or 8 years I realized I was going nowhere, and there was no help for me, so I went back to school.
I think also what's significant about her experience is that she trained almost 20 managers, all of whom were male, who surpassed her not only in their positions but in their pay, even while she was training them to do positions that were to supervise her.
Exactly. That happened over and over and over. You know, I was given the yearly 50 cents. I don't know if I can say that or not, but 50 cents an hour raise, plus merit increases, plus exceptional reviews. There just was always obstacles put in front of me saying, you have to do this, you have to do that, where the males weren't held accountable for the same thing. I mean, two of my managers were brought in off the street without any retail experience, without a degree whatsoever in marketing. I trained them, and they were probably making 3 times what I made.
Jennifer, now this is a class action lawsuit, so it assumes that there are many people within Walmart, many women, who experience similar treatment by the Walmart family. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Why don't you expand on that?
And, of course, we use the term family very loosely.
Right. The lawsuit alleges that there is a systematic pattern of discrimination and that the corporate culture within Walmart, led by the Walmart corporate headquarters in Arkansas, has a corporate culture of gender stereotyping that leads to across-the-board gender discrimination. One of their arguments was that each of these decisions was made, you know, in the individual stores by individual store managers, and so, you know, as a corporation, it can't possibly be held accountable as a class action. But obviously, the judge agreed with us in saying, well, there's such centralized decision-making that comes from the top down that contributes to this corporate culture of gender stereotyping. So at this point, it could include up to 1.6 million women employees, former and current female employees, that they've been paid differently, that they've been promoted differently, that they've been trained. They haven't received the proper training in order to get promotions. I think Claudia is just one example of thousands of women that, you know, we've spoken with over 1,000 ourselves in this case, women who have almost identical experiences. Maybe they're in Alaska, maybe they're in Florida, but stories are stunningly the same.
And this has to do with just promotions or also equal pay for equal work?
Yeah, promotions and pay.
This is definitely, a lot of the times I was turned down or told I had to do this for a promotion or that for promotion came totally from home office. I was told it was policy.
Right, and we've heard that a lot from women when they say, oh, well, you know, we don't have women in those positions, or, you know, the reason why a man was promoted is because he has a family that he needs to take care
yeah.
of. I mean, things as blatant as that, you know, oh, you know, women can't be managers, women should be at home. I mean, really, and these are not isolated incidents. I mean, we've heard this over and over again. And also what, Claudia, what you were saying before, too, about how people go in, women go into these positions with a lot of hope. I mean, Walmart puts forth this image, we take care of our workers, come work for us, and you can have a career with us, you know, like you were
saying.
They do. Yeah, going from the cart pushers all the way to general manager. And it often takes a while before the women realize, wait a second, something is wrong here. Like, why is it that I'm training men, you know, who as trainees are making more than me and then become managers more quickly than I do? You know, and so that's another thing that we hear over and over again.
And that happened, I can't be sure, but between 18 and 20 managers. I know I had one female manager, but she was only like 6 months with me. And other than that, they were all males. For 9 years, it was all males. And they were all put in as managers for me to train. And this went on and on and on.
Right.
Claudia, I wonder if also where you were working was affected at all by efforts to unionize. And had there been less order on the part of Walmart to prevent unionization, if that would have certainly alleviated much of the discriminatory conditions that you face, which now are one of the causes of actions in a major lawsuit.
Over the time I was a team leader in marketing and membership, we had several meetings where the union, it was a big, you'd have the club, a huge thing come from home office talking about unions. Unions are coming into your club. So we were instantly brought in and pretty much coached on what we were to say if we saw somebody come to the club passing out union cards. We were to go right to the general manager, and that person would be removed from the club. We used to have a practice where we would allow people to set up tables outside Sam's Club, like Girl Scouts or that type of thing. And Walmart stopped that because the union, I guess, took them to court, and the union would have been allowed to set up outside of Walmart and Sam's Club. So they stopped that. So we couldn't have the Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, or anybody in front of the club anymore soliciting. So we were pretty much told and to tell our staff, if anybody comes in and mentions union or if anybody in your department asks about unions, you're totally to discourage them. That was what we were taken in this meeting and pretty much forced down our throat.
As I'm sure you know, I mean, Walmart has been notorious in union busting, and it's actually become part of the way that they train their employees. I mean, from the top down, I mean, there are directives that say keeping unions out in your store is just as important as the items that you sell, just as important as dealing with inventory, keeping unions out. And if that means sometimes breaking the law, then that's just all a part of the cost of business. They take that, they absorb that as part of the cost of business. And because it's so huge, those costs, those lawsuits or whatever, just become absorbed. And we've definitely seen that. I mean, that's definitely part of the problem.
I was told by the district operator about an employee that was going to sue over things that happened to her years ago in discrimination. The DO at that time, he told me that, well, let her sue. We have so many attorneys that will make a difference. She'll never get anywhere.
And this is one of the reasons why, you know, it's so important to bring forth this kind of impact litigation or class action suit, is because individually, these individual workers may not have the resources to be able to bring forth suits for whatever reason, whether it's individual attorneys are afraid to take on Walmart because of their really hard-nosed approach to lawsuits, but also because there's power in numbers. In addition, the importance of injunctive relief. I mean, our most important goal in bringing this lawsuit is that Walmart change its policies and practices in the way that it treats, the way that it promotes, the way that it trains, and the way it pays its women employees.
Have they started to do that already in response to the lawsuit? Have they made any changes at all?
Apparently, we've heard that they have started to make some changes. They've created a diversity officer position, which is headed by a woman, and they have what are called diversity initiatives, and saying that now the people's benefits or compensation and bonuses are going to be tied to diversity goals. So that's something that's new. There's also going to be some changes in the way that they enable associates to express interest in certain positions and in certain geographic locations and specific training and leadership programs and that kind of thing. So there's some talk about making changes. Some of these have been implemented. I don't think all of them have, but I'm sure they would say it had nothing to do with the lawsuit and has to do with their commitment to diversity overall. But, you know, it has to be noted that some of this information was distributed to the associates on the day that the class certification decision came down.
I think we can pretty much also count that without an order of the court, et cetera, that it would dissipate very quickly if they did set up any form of, shall we say, tentative relief. Jennifer, this is the largest lawsuit of its kind in the country. Give us some understanding of what it was like to accumulate this data, the anecdotal component, the statistical data, because it's really awesome that this extends across the country to what is the largest employer in the world. It's
yes.
Really a monumental effort on the part of the plaintiffs and certainly on the part of their counsel to put this suit together. And, of course, a wonderful triumph that's very unexpected in the courts today that it was certified as a class action.
Right. Well, one of the most important things when you're bringing class action lawsuits has to do with statistics and making sure that you have the statistics to back up what the claims are. Because we're talking about, you know, hundreds and thousands of people, there are 700,000 women that work at Walmart right now. And so it's really important to get, you know, statisticians on board. And all that actually even happened before we even thought about bringing a case, because you have to have the numbers back it up. And so actually on the website that we have, which is walmartclass.com, there is a link that you can actually look at the statistical report. I mean, those are significant. Those were the first indication to us that there was something seriously wrong with what was going on at Walmart. I mean, the numbers of women that Walmart had in 1999 were less than some of its competitors had in 1975. So we knew that there was something significant about the way that Walmart was treating its women employees. And then, you know, once we started making contact with individual women, we just became flooded with calls. We've spoken, you know, like I said, with over 1,000 women just individually who have, you know, told us these stories, anecdotal stories over and over again. On that website as well, we have, you know, a list of over 100 declarations by women who are involved in the lawsuit, just chronicling what their stories have been and chronicling their experiences. And so from there, the lawsuit was filed in June of 2001. So there was a lot of discovery that went on to try and for us to prove why this case should go forward as a class action, meaning that there was centralized decision making and there was a corporate culture, and the judge seemed to agree.
And in addition to making Walmart change what it does, are there reparations that you're asking for those people that were discriminated against in the past?
Yes, absolutely. And we're definitely doing that. I mean, but we would not make a settlement. We would not agree to a settlement that did not include injunctive relief, did not include a very strong policy and procedure change in the way that it promotes, trains, and pays its women.
And where will this case be in the next months, the next year? And where will the workers be? Because one of the things about litigation is that it takes an interminable time to seek and to accomplish the relief when people have been hurt. So what's the process now?
In terms of what's going to happen to the next steps legally, Walmart has 10 days to appeal. So they have until this Friday to decide whether or not they want to appeal to the Ninth Circuit. And the Ninth Circuit has discretion whether or not to take the appeal. And even if they do, it does not stay the rest of the case, so the case will continue. On July 28th, there is a meeting with both sides with Judge Jenkins. We are going to request that the judge schedule a trial date starting next year.
And that's a pretty aggressive bird in the background there. This must be from California that we're speaking to you.
Is that what it was?
I hope it's a bird.
And Jennifer, you mentioned a website where people can get updated information on the suit.
Sure, and that's Walmart Class, which is one word, .com. And it has just links to various, it has the statistical reports and it has the declarations by the women. It also has an update about what's going on with the case and that kind of thing. At this point, it may even have the decision, the class cert decision, but I'm not sure. If it's not up there yet, it probably will be soon.
And Claudia, as we wind up this segment, how do you feel about the organizing that went into bringing these women together to do what should have been done without litigation? But, of course, we do need to assert our power collectively to accomplish things. How do you feel about the efforts to bring people together in this sex discrimination suit against this really voracious employer?
Sorry about the bird.
I feel like we're getting intimate and another opinion
there. The first bird we've had on the show.
Never mind. But anyway, I am so grateful that somebody, Jennifer and all her colleagues, took it upon themselves with the risk they took to go to bat for us women. And I can't be more pleased. And I think all women who have worked for Walmart and continue to work for Walmart will benefit from this.
Well, Jennifer Shin, staff attorney, equal rights advocates, and Claudia Renati, plaintiff in the Walmart lawsuit and former Sam's Club associate, we can't thank you enough for your efforts on behalf of all women and all employees who are struggling for a meaningful and a fair workplace. And whatever the bird is in the background, whatever its name, we'd like to thank you also for your contribution. It gives you the kind of spontaneous
quality.
It's the
quality. One thing I forgot to take care of.
You got the bird.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been
thank
a pleasure speaking to you. And how about a little bit of Abby Lincoln?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, and now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
It's about time, literally, to focus on and protest the rising rate of unemployment of males of African ancestry in New York City. And that's exactly what members of the City Council's Black, Latino, and Asian Caucus did at City Hall, spurred on by the Reverend Al Sharpton. The protests spotlighted studies that indicate that more than 50% of black males in New York City are unemployed. While the march and rally emphasized joblessness among black men, speaker after speaker similarly condemned the unemployment rates for Latinos, particularly highlighted against the talk about economic recovery.
The City Council successfully fought for a $20 million job bill in the city budget to combat structural unemployment through job training programs. The mayor had tried to limit this incentive to $10 million. A speaker, Brooklyn's council member and mayoral candidate Charles Barron, stressed that the city should use its purchasing power to make sure that city contractors hire people of color. And politically active pastor of the House of the Lord Pentecostal Church, the Reverend Herbert Daughtry, called for a withdrawal from Iraq in order to free up resources to use here at home.
All of the speakers strongly voiced their concerns that unemployment is a major problem in New York City and that they would be back with more demonstrations and proposed legislation until the unemployment crisis in communities of color was addressed.
And now to the rally with the Reverend Al Sharpton, Council Members Barron, Montserrat Davis, and the Reverend Herbert Daughtry.
What do we want? Job!
What do we want?
Job!
What do we want?
Job! because 51% of black men are unemployed. Over 30% of Latino men are unemployed.
We are not only concerned about brothers, but many of our sisters are unemployed.
We need to deal with the graphic picture in New York that while they're talking about an economic recovery, we have rapid unemployment in areas of color in this city.
Amen.
I'm surrounded by members of the African American, Latino, and Asian caucus, as well as other members of the council, who are saying to the city, you must deal with this critical issue. How dare you think you can bring the Republican convention to a city where half the black men and a third of the Latino men can't even. Construction sites where people have jobs. They don't even live in New York. We're going to real estate office. We're going to show where the jobs are. Mayor Bloomberg, Governor Pataki, George Bush, you can't tell us to lift ourselves up by our bootstraps when you left us standing in our underwear. We need millions of dollars in public funds to deal with the job crisis. We need every contractor, particularly those getting these no-bid and low-bid contracts, to have to deal with the job crisis. We need programs that are training and providing training. And we can assure you we're going mass job hunting in New York City.
Right.
Bring the money home.
Right.
We want the money.
punishment here. We want to see everybody employed. We're going to keep on marching. We're going to keep on doing what we have to do until this situation has been eradicated. Thank you very much.
Let us hear from the great state of Brooklyn, Councilwoman Tess James.
The biggest borough in New York City, and we left there with Fino, New York.
That's right. Give black men a job.
Provide jobs to African-American and Latino men. This is the day of a revolution that's coming from the bottom up. Mr. Mayor, don't come to Brooklyn talking about building an arena and a stadium in Manhattan when, in fact, it doesn't address our interests. We need these individuals to build houses, to build skills, to build schools, to build community-based centers. Don't give my children a public housing, nothing more than some sneakers, Mr. Mayor. They need jobs, and they need opportunities. We need jobs, and we need schools, and we need community-based organizations, and we need funding. We need to go to these unions and tell them that you need to provide more opportunities to African-American. I am tired of going to downtown Brooklyn and seeing all this development going on while black men are looking up at individuals who come from Long Island and other parts of New York State who do not provide any opportunities. It's time for a revolution, my brothers and sisters. I am a black woman standing with Councilwoman Foster, and we're looking for BMWs, black men working. How many of you want to be BMWs? BMWs. I say, Mr. Mayor, I don't believe in affirmative action. I want all the action. All the action. No jobs. Don't build jails, Mr. Mayor. Build jobs. Provide me with jobs. Jobs. Not jails. Jobs. Not jails. Jobs. Not jails. Jobs. Not jails. Jobs. Thank you very much. Let's go forward as one. All this development in the city of New York, all these city contracts, you have to say, in order to be a responsible bidder, a responsible contract, you have to hire locally. And locally means the five boroughs. Locally means people in public housing. Ingersoll, Whitman, Farragut, Red Hook, Marcy, and all the public developments in the Brooklyn. And where they're facing double-digit employment. Now is the time. Now we will rise. One unit, one family, until justice is won. Thank you.
Every week, we go hit the streets. We go turn up the street heat until we get jobs in this town. No justice.
No peace.
No justice.
No peace.
No justice.
No peace.
No jail.
No peace.
No jail.
No peace.
What do we want?
Jobs.
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 When do we want them?
Now.
When do we want them?
Now.
When do we want them?
Now.
Half a million boots went slogging through.
You've been listening to a protest march and rally about the devastatingly high unemployment among blacks and Latinos in New York City. Special thanks to Ricochet for the sound of the protest march and rally.
They called me out. It was
this has been a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special.
Your path, brother. Can you spare a dime, buddy? Can you spare a dime?